Welcome to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Natasha Moore. Most of us are pretty sure that we have something called free will, but what this actually involves is far less certain. Recent discoveries in neuroscience can be taken as suggesting that we don't have free will, that our choices and actions are just determined by our genes, and that everything can be explained by neuroscience. But this then raises significant questions about how responsible we are for the decisions that we make. You know, did my genes make me do it? Julian Baggini is a British philosopher. He's the author of a whole bunch of books, including The Pig That Wants to Be Eaten and the Oxford Very Short Introduction to Atheism. His latest book is called Freedom Regained, The Possibility of Free Will. I had the pleasure of interviewing Julian at the recent Sydney Writers' Festival, and we started our conversation by addressing this challenge that neuroscience makes, or seems to make, to our belief that we have free will.
Well, it seems to be because there's a kind of a view knocking around, which a lot of people, if they think it's the kind of the view of, you know, intelligent, informed opinion, that there's some sense in which science has kind of shown that we definitely don't have free will. So it's ceased being a matter of philosophical speculation, and it's become a matter of empirical scientific fact. And that basically the mature thing is just to accept this and live with it in some way. And anyone else is kind of deluding themselves that there's anything else called free will. And that view gets put out quite a lot, sometimes by scientists and neuroscientists, sometimes by just scientifically minded writers. But, you know, I think 9 times out of 10, if I hear about free will, I see something on free will, it's saying why we don't have it.
But do you think that, I mean, we can have quite a two-dimensional idea of freedom, that we would only have free will if we could make these choices without any external influence, as though you could make like a choice in a vacuum, as though that's what freedom would be?
Yeah, that's right. It is a bit, once you sort of set it out clearly in that way, I don't think it takes long to think that's a bit suspicious, you know. I mean, so the Dutch neuroscientist Dick Schwab wrote a book called We Are Our Brains, or You Are Your Brains. I'm not sure how it was translated, but you know, he has this point. He picks up as his definition of free will something like the capacity to make the choice unconstrained by intrinsic or extrinsic factors or something. I thought, that's bizarre. Who would think we had that kind of capacity? But, you know, I think that in an unthought through way, people want to believe that we have something like that, because the moment we start to acknowledge that we make our choices because of some kind of combination of nature and nurture, that's what it boils down to, then, you know, people think, well, you know, where's my individual agency? Where's that special agency which I have? So, in other words, we do know that we don't completely make our choices entirely in a vacuum, that they're constrained. When someone behaves really badly, you know, if you know mitigating circumstances, you tend to be a bit more understanding, for example, you know. And even, you know, on little day-to-day levels, there's this lovely word I came across the other day called hanger. Have you heard about this? So this is when you're angry because you're hungry. Yeah, to be hangry. If we know someone well and we know they're susceptible to that, and we see them getting a bit hangry, then, you know, we respond to them in a slightly different way than if we just think they've got angry for no reason whatsoever. So actually, I don't think it's a million miles from common sense to say, you know, that our choices are not absolutely constrained. But the bottom line is, common sense also recognizes the fact that to a significant degree, we do have the capacity to, you know, respond to reasons and incentives, to think about things and alter our behaviour accordingly. And for that reason, we think it's very important that people are held to account and not just let off the hook by saying, oh, well, you know, he's bound to do that.
Obviously, traditionally in the West, this question about free will has been kind of a God question. Mm. You know, there's been a spectrum within that of kind of the Calvinist end, where everything's sort of predetermined by God, to a stronger emphasis on human action and choice. Does that Christian background to this debate, does that still kind of influence the way that philosophers and others think about this issue now?
Well, I think it has done. I mean, it seems, and certainly based on what various other sort of scholars have said, that, you know, this Christian background is vital to it. Because essentially the idea here is that, you know, Christianity in its versions has ideas of punishment and reward, which are eternal, actually. It's eternal salvation, eternal damnation. that's pretty serious. So, you know, to justify that, you have to kind of work out, the responsibility has to be pretty strong, you know. It's not enough to say, you know, you're 50% responsible for what you do, and therefore a just God will send you to hell. That seems really just completely unfair. You have to be 100% responsible, or it doesn't kind of work. Or, you know, you have to do the sort of Calvinist thing, which is somehow completely invert it and kind of say, you know, somehow predestination is compatible with this, which seems very, very odd. So I kind of think that the whole way in which we frame the debate, the whole notion of free will, which has become problematic, which is one which seems to hinge on a kind of an absolute power to do what you determine without any external or internal constraints. I think that emerged out of that sort of Christian history we have, which kind of demands that humanity must be, the responsibility of humanity, I suppose, is a core issue. And I think most people would conclude, therefore, has to be something which you can't make any excuses for.
One of the key terms in the Christian debate about free will is, of course, sin. You know, the whole Apostle Paul's idea that, you know, what I want to do, I don't do, and what I don't want to do, that's what I do. Do you think we've kind of lost that sense of there's this gap in control, this gap between even what we will and what we actually do?
Well, and again, that's quite interesting because, you know, on the one hand, I think that the sort of Christian background hasn't been helpful in that it's tended to result in this idea of freedom as being absolute. There are, yeah, it's quite a, obviously, it's a very rich tradition.
Yes.
I don't need to tell you and your listeners that. And you know, one of the things I think which you find in, I think, most religious traditions is they do have that kind of real sense of, you know, humanity being sort of trapped in a kind of fallen state, if you like. Now, you know, the idea of original sin is often extremely sort of abhorrent to people of an atheist kind of disposition because they think, you know, the idea that you can be deemed guilty from birth without having done anything wrong is kind of just fundamentally unjust. And also the whole idea that, you know, the stain of Adam can be passed on. But, you know, that's only one way of interpreting it. If you put it in other terms, which is simply that, you know, human beings are born imperfect and we have good and bad within us and, you know, we're all inherently going to err and so forth. And along with that, you know, we struggle to be in complete control of what we do, and there are forces influencing our behaviour which we don't have, you know, full control over. You know, that I think that's quite an accurate picture of human nature, actually. And in that sense, losing it is a loss, you know.
And of course, even though we tend to think of freedom as being able to pursue our own desires, we often don't acknowledge that, well, we didn't choose those desires and we don't kind of spontaneously create them.
Well, yes. I mean, again, this is quite interesting as well, because I think that's not so much about Christianity. It's more about the kind of consumerist sort of, you know, democratic sort of individualist culture that we has emerged in the West, where, yes, freedom is very much seen as the capacity to, you know, pursue your own desires. And I think that's not a very rich conception of free will. It's not a very meaningful one either, really, because, you know, unless you, you know, what unless your desires are worth pursuing, first of all, there's not much value in having the freedom to pursue them. And again, if you look through some traditions, philosophical traditions and religious traditions, there's this idea which sometimes recurs, which is that freedom actually isn't about that ability to just choose whatever, anything you want. It's actually the capacity for your actions to flow from your best nature, as it were. And so, you know, there are various ways of looking at God, for example, which says, you know, God is not free if that means God could choose to do just anything, because God is purely good. Therefore, in a sense, God must do what God must do. He can only do what is for the best. So God's freedom is not the freedom just to choose anything. It's a kind of a pure freedom, it's sometimes said, to just simply act fully in accordance with his nature and his goodness. And that kind of idea of freedom is perhaps, you know, one which, you know, obviously it doesn't exactly fit a kind of secular worldview. But I think there's a sense in which, you know, I think as individuals, I think we are freer if we are, you know, sometimes submitting to some kind of constraints on ourselves and authority on ourselves. We're recognizing that we can't do just anything and that we shouldn't just follow our desires on a whim. Because actually, the freedom purely to follow your desires can easily turn into just being a slave to your desires.
And I suppose that introduces ideas about purpose, you know, freedom is kind of conforming to your purpose, then there's a kind of teleology that's problematic from a secular point of view.
Yes, it is, because I mean, I don't think you can make much sense of a purpose in that kind of teleological sense of some ultimate goal. I don't think you can have that. But I think you can have an idea of kind of, you know, acting according to, you know, your best nature, your best self. And there's that kind of ethical project of, you know, living as good a life as you can, being the best person you can be, making the most of the one life you have, which is, you know, the classical kind of secular humanist way of putting things.
You're listening to Life and Faith. If you've just joined us, I'm Natasha Moore, and I'm speaking about free will with philosopher Julian Baggini. You talked a bit about neuroscience and genetics. So neuroscience is kind of one of the potential villains of this story of us losing our sense of free will. What's its contribution been? Can you sum it up?
Well, in some ways, I think its contribution is vastly overstated, because I think that the fundamental problem emerges as soon as you believe, if you do believe, that human beings are fully a part of nature and we're made up entirely of, you know, atoms. There's nothing else there, which, you know, incidentally, as a lot of people will recognise, is not a view which is inherently anti-religious, actually. There are plenty of theologians who would say that, you know, they deny dualism in the sense that there's immaterial stuff and material stuff. So that in itself isn't an anti-religious position that's often sort of portrayed as such. So once you accept that, it seems you have the problem that, you know, everything in nature just follows the laws of physics and behaves according to those physical laws. And therefore, it seems hard to understand how we can have agency in there. Now, all neuroscience really does is, I think it gives us some sort of vivid illustrations of this. It enables us to kind of see some of the detail. So, you know, you can look into the brain and you can see what's going on in the brain, and you can observe that when you make a choice, it does seem that, you know, behind all of that is a load of neuronal activity, a lot of which occurs before you've got any conscious awareness of it at all. So I think it really sort of makes vivid what the real problem is, rather than introduces a completely new one.
Yeah, I've been reading a bit of Marilyn Robinson, the novelist, on this question of neuroscience, and, you know, as though seeing something on an MRI explains it away. Mm. You know, there's a spot and that represents fear. So she gives this example of if I and a higher ape encounter a lion, then you might see something similar happening in our brains. But if you present both of us with a subpoena, yeah, then the similarity vanishes. You know, we kind of have an idea that this physical thing is more real than human culture.
Yeah. I mean, that question of what's more real, I think that's perhaps the nub of it, because there's a kind of reductionist assumption which has been very useful as a sort of a methodological assumption in science, which is that if you want to understand how things work, you should try and, you know, dig down to the most fundamental physical level possible. And I think that kind of idea of reductionism has somehow sort of permeated the culture. So we always kind of think that when you see the kind of physical stuff under the microscope or the MRI scan, you're seeing what's really going on, and everything else isn't really real. But I think that's kind of philosophically very sort of unsophisticated and quite wrong. I mean, you know, so for example, you know, one of the first things you learn when you start to do science as a kid, and you're amazed that this apparently solid table, and note the word apparently, is actually largely empty space. It's made of atoms and everything. That's astonishing. But of course, does that mean the table doesn't really exist? It's really just atoms. That's the wrong way of putting it, really. It's a table. At that level of organization and at the level at which we are, it is a table. The fact that beneath it, you know, the fundamental structure is molecular, it doesn't mean it's not really a table as well. I think once you start pushing the idea that the only things that really exist are those things which are at the lower level of physical description, it just seems obviously wrong. And what's particularly interesting about this, of course, is the whole attempt to undermine the idea of free will by neuroscience is not consistent with that approach, because neural events, of course, are nowhere near the most fundamental level of physical description, right? Neurons and brains are already at that level of the biological, which is about how matter organizes itself in quite complex ways. It's not at the most fundamental physical level. So, you know, a consistent reductionist would say it's nothing to do with the brain either, really.
So do you have a sense of consciousness as something special, that's something rather marvellous?
Well, it is. I mean, I think it is something special and rather marvellous, and has to be said, still somewhat mysterious. You know, and perhaps we'll never fully understand how it can exist. The real question is whether consciousness does anything, because that's the real question, I think. And some of these neuroscientific experiments have kind of suggested it doesn't, because they've, you know, shown that stuff is going on unconsciously before we're consciously aware of it. Now, the point about that is, though, I mean, first of all, what you show about some little task in a laboratory to make an arbitrary movement or something, the idea that that therefore tells you everything you need to know about decisions you make in real life seems implausible. But secondly, I think that actually we shouldn't be remotely surprised that the vast majority of what we do is driven by things which we're not consciously aware of. I mean, I will start to sort of stutter now, because the example I'm going to give is that, you know, just start to become self-aware when you're having the next conversation you have. And of course, what you'll notice is that you're not kind of consciously, internally preparing a script, which you're then kind of reading out loud. Your words are kind of coming out, and you know, you don't have any kind of conscious pre-awareness of them. In unusual circumstances, you do. So, you know, if you're trying to tell someone that you love them and you're trying to build up the courage, you might rehearse, you know, I love you, I love you. And then you get in front of them and you say, you know, can I borrow your pencil or whatever it might be. That's unusual. That's not the norm. So whatever the conscious mind is doing, whatever the role of consciousness is in guiding our decisions, it's not that kind of micromanager of every single step of the way. It's something else. Now, the idea that it doesn't contribute to nothing at all, I just think it's implausible. There's too much evidence that it does affect things. So, you know, and one of the nicest examples, actually, is experiments with students which prime them. In other words, they kind of get them more inclined to believe one view or another, and they can be primed either to believe that free will is an illusion or to believe that free will exists. And when students are primed to believe that free will is an illusion, in a subsequent little test they do, they're more likely to cheat, right? So what we have here is a very nice example of how experimentally it can be shown that a change of belief alters your change, makes a difference to your behavior. And so, you know, the idea that you could just completely do away with that and say, no, it really has to be all explained at the level of neurons or even sort of quarks or something seems to be sort of deeply implausible.
Do you think that this should encourage a kind of humility in us? That, you know, we don't understand ourselves fully and we don't have as much control as we like to think?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's true. I think humility is generally a good thing. And this is another example of where it is. And, you know, and I think that there are some people who, I mean, Sam Harris is one of these people who's been sort of, you know, very sort of black and white, free will is just an illusion. He's got some sort of, you know, nice memorable lines about that, but I don't think the argument stacks up. But, you know, he argues, you know, that actually this does make him a better person because it makes him more compassionate and understanding about people. And also, again, it also makes him less likely to sort of take credit for what he does. But it's a double-edged sword, of course, because taking credit for what you do, you also don't take the blame. So it's responsibility for what you do. Indeed. But yeah, no, I think a certain amount of humility is in order. You know, I kind of think, in broad terms, my kind of view of human nature is informed by the philosophy of Monty Python, I think, and British comedy. It's the idea, you know, I think it's a kind of British existentialism. I think when you stand back at humans and you look at us, you know, in lots of ways we're wonderful, but we're also quite ridiculous and absurd and subject to all sorts of hubristic beliefs about how wonderful we are and our higher dignity. And, you know, I think a sort of ironic but humane and compassionate kind of self-mockery is perhaps a good thing to try and cultivate.
I'm Natasha Moore, and you've been listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with philosopher Julian Baggini about free will. If you did, then please let us know by leaving a rating or a review on iTunes. Just type Centre for Public Christianity in the search box to find us. Next week, we'll be looking at the role of religion in discovering the meaning of life and the meaning in life with renowned social researcher Hugh McKay. Join us then.